This week on The Score, did we learn anything from the results on Election Day? What do winning candidates plan to do now that they are elected officials? Have American businesses been fishing with dynamite? All this and more on The Score, so don't go away.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
Welcome back to The Score from Bering Drift. I'm your host, Rick Sincere. There was big election news in Virginia and around the country this week. For the first time since the 20th century, Democrats took control of the General Assembly in all five statewide offices. The Score talked with both winning and losing candidates on election night, so let's get started. Elliot Harding was an independent candidate for the Virginia State Senate in the 25th District, running against incumbent Democrat Creed Eads. While he was not elected, Harding exceeded the vote totals that his campaign managers predicted when he entered the race. We spoke at the Aberdeen Barn Restaurant in Charlottesville soon after the election results were announced. Elliot Harding, it's election night here in Charlottesville, Albemarle County. You just ran a race for the 25th District in the State Senate. What is your reaction to the results?
I think that we ran a really honorable campaign. The election results are still coming in. I think that we're going to top over 20,000 votes tonight, which is a really remarkable figure. It's more than the figure we were aiming for. I just need to note that the turnout in the Charlottesville and Albemarle region today was remarkable. And I have to give credit where credit's due. The Democrats are organized. They have a machine. They run a up and down ticket race. I think we saw that in the city council results, and people don't budge. And, I think it's been an awesome time running in this very large district, seeing the six counties, the city of Charlottesville, and really identifying unique issues in the area. I'll also note that we did win Allegheny County, Highland County, Bath County still coming in. And these are areas where my opponent's from, and I think it's a real reflection that Western and rural Virginia is being left behind, particularly by the Democratic Party. And whether it's this race or in the future, I think people need to really start taking a look and seeing that there's an underserved population in the rural and western portion of the Commonwealth. So I've had a great time connecting with voters. And, I'm born and raised here in the Albemarle, Charlottesville area. I was excited to get my message out there. It's a very diverse message, pushing more liberal views or traditionally liberal views on things like criminal justice reform, going against, corporate monopolies and donations in the General Assembly, protecting people's property rights, but also, the more conservative things like the Second Amendment, less spending, less taxation. I think these are messages that did resonate. And I think that we put up an honorable campaign.
You've been involved in politics for a long time, but mostly working behind the scenes. This is your first time as a candidate. Mm-hmm. What did you learn being a candidate that you didn't know before?
I learned that there's a difference between obviously being an operative and being a candidate, and so far as what you can and can't do, and the types of interviews you do, places you go, but money's always a big issue. The thing that really frustrated me and the thing that I learned the most is as much rhetoric that might come from a party platform or even a candidate's platform about a particular issues, they might walk a different walk, and people might not bat a lash, because at the end of the day, we still live in this hyper-partisan time where people will revert back to their proverbial corners and be able to live with the flaws of their candidates or their party in order to attain victory. We've seen that with the Republican Party, obviously, nationally for the past few years. We see it in the Democratic Party here in Virginia. I was trying to kind of disrupt that. It's not yet ready to be disrupted, but I think over time that message is resonating. We've got a lot of supporters at the grassroots level that would have traditionally voted Democratic who voted for me. And I think we're going to just build on that, whether it's through politics or just community organizing or even business and other type of issue area PACs, things like that.
In retrospect, do you think you might have done better if you had chosen a different seat to run for, or if you waited for another election?
As far as the seats are concerned, you know, it's difficult to say. I mean, I ran for a very large seat. You know, state senate is 200,000 people. I ran against a 30-year incumbent, a machine. I mean, he was the Democratic nominee for attorney general and governor. He's probably the second most senior member of the Democratic Party, and he's running around saying he's going to be the chair of the Finance Committee in the Senate. I probably would have done better against anybody other than my opponent, so I'll give him credit where credit's due. But I do think that it was a race where there are a lot of people that felt like their voices weren't being heard. And I'm happy that I ran for this seat because I was able to connect with them and make them connect with them, and we felt mobilized together and energized to try to rise up and at least speak some truth to power on the issues.
Take off your candidate's hat for a moment, put back on your operative's hat. Turnout across Virginia was much larger than expected, not in line with previous elections of this sort. What do you think explains that?
I think that the Democrats, after 2017, realized that they were a name in a jar away from getting the majority in the House, and they smelled blood in the water. They got the redistricting, and some of the courts struck down some districts, and I think they want the majority, and I think they got the majority tonight. I haven't seen the statewide polls, but I went in today feeling like they were going to get it, and everything I've seen, I feel like they might get it, and, you know, again, I blame the Republicans for being too much back on their heels. They play too much defense. I don't think that they've gone on offense at all. I haven't heard any new ideas out of the Republican Party in Virginia in the past 25 years. It's what's the other side going to do, and this is what we're not going to let them do. At some point, you got to be a problem solver. You got to come up with some innovative solutions, and it can't just be tax cuts every day. I love tax cuts, don't get me wrong, but when it comes to fixing people's health care, fixing people's infrastructure, fixing people's broadband, fixing people's, you know, schools, things like that, you've got to be out at the forefront with innovative ideas that connect with people. And I don't think the GOP is doing that. And I think the Democrats, I don't agree with their solutions, but I do agree that they're identifying problems and they're running a very unified campaign, and the Republicans aren't. And I think that that's probably going to end up resulting in a loss of the majorities here in Virginia come tomorrow morning.
That certainly explains the behaviors of the institutional political parties. What do you think motivated Democratic voters or independent voters to come out in this election to vote for Democrats rather than vote for Republicans?
I mean, there's something to be said for national politics, right? I mean, Northern Virginia is the most populous area of the Commonwealth, and that's right in the backyard of Washington, D.C. And D.C. currently, all the talk is Donald Trump. And this state did not go for Trump in 2016. I don't expect it to go for Trump in 2020. And, you know, we got the vice president coming around doing a tour through, you know, several areas of the Commonwealth that are very volatile swing districts, you know, like the 17th for Bryce Reeves and down in Virginia Beach. I didn't understand that logic of the Republicans to do that. I don't understand why they thought Vice President Pence was going to somehow help any Republican that was in office. And I think that this is not just a reflection of 2016, but it's people gearing up for 2020. I think these people wanted to take the majority, and they wanted to send a message that the Democrats are mobilized for 2020, and they did. And we live in the Charlottesville-Albemarle area, historic highs. All day today I saw that the Charlottesville-Albemarle area might have been leading in the turnout percentage. I don't know if that ended up being the case, but it was up there, and that's because the Democratic machine here is organized, and you know, you got to give them credit. It's something to be reckoned with.
We're talking to Elliot Harding, who's been a frequent guest on The Score. He's a candidate for the 25th District State Senate seat. And I just want to know, Elliot, what are your plans for the immediate future?
I've been on the trail a lot. I've burnt up a lot of miles, hours away from my wife. We're newlyweds. We're only 6 months into our marriage. I've got a lot of bills to pay, a lot of personal finances put into this. So I'm just going to be focusing on my work. I love my work. It's criminal defense. My biggest issue on the campaign was criminal justice reform. Insofar as political stuff is concerned, you're not going to see me involved with party stuff. You're not going to see me involved with campaigns. I might work with some folks across party lines to maybe get some criminal justice pack issue type of pack together in the next few months to try to help with that. But down the road, you never know. But in the immediate future, I'm just going to focus on work and focus on criminal justice reform.
Time for a vacation from politics.
Absolutely. Yes, sir.
Thanks again for joining us, Elliot, and we'll be seeing you in the near future.
Yes, sir. I appreciate it.
Thanks.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
Senator Cree Deeds was first elected to his current office in a special election in 2001. On Tuesday, he was re-elected for his fifth full four-year term. We chatted at the local Democrats' victory party at Three Notched Brewery in Charlottesville. You'll hear a lot of cheers and noise in the background. He starts by telling me how to drive across the 25th District without leaving it.
The way you get stay in the district and go here, if you're coming from Lexington up Route 11, you turn in at the East Lexington Market, and you go on the old Buena Vista Road to the South River, and then you go up South River to Vesuvius. You take Route 56 over to Nelson, over to Roseland, basically, and you could stay totally in the 25th District. Now, when you caught me unawares, I wasn't thinking about that, and basically, on Labor Day, I thought of this way, this route later on, but it's not a route that I would normally take because it just takes a long time.
Yeah, it would be an abnormal route for anybody to take.
It would just be, it's a beautiful route because you're through Crabtree Falls, and over to Montebello. It's really incredible country. But you know, the nature camp where, you know, that was very important to my son is up there, and basically in Vesuvius up the South River Road. So it's a road that I know about. I've been on, and I'm surprised that I didn't remember it then. I apologize.
Well, that's okay. It's an easy mistake to make. Senator Deeds, you've won re-election tonight. All the other candidates I've spoken to this evening were running for the first time. And I've asked him, what did you learn as a candidate? What did you learn as a candidate after so many elections that you didn't learn before?
Well, it's just unbelievable that your contact with voters at doors and at voting places and working their workplaces, it's always interesting. You learn what's important to different people. The things it's hard for me to point to something specific that I learned this time that I hadn't learned before, except the individual experiences with the individual voters. And the electorate has changed pretty dramatically since I was first on the ballot in 1987. And my electorate, the electorate that I represent, has changed pretty dramatically. And so it's always interesting. Hunter Andrews used to call this, he used to say that those of us who have the opportunity to serve have to be refreshed by the people every so often. And elections are, when we are refreshed by the people, it's a very humbling experience. And for me, this one was especially humbling.
You earned more votes in Charlottesville today than there were ballots printed before the election. What do you think explains the high voter turnout, not only in Charlottesville and in the 25th District, but across the state of Virginia today?
Well, I think to a large extent, what you saw today was voter reaction to President Trump. There are some people that are on fire for the president. They think he's the greatest thing since sliced bread. But the large majority of Virginians have a very different view. And I think that his rhetoric, his actions, have caused a dramatic increase in Democratic support throughout the country and throughout Virginia. Certainly we've seen that since 2017 in Virginia. So that had a big support, but we've had better candidates. They've done a better job of connecting with voters. So, while I give some credit to President Trump, I also give a lot of credit to our candidates who have worked very hard.
The last time the Democrats controlled the General Assembly, you were still in the House of Delegates.
I was in the House, yes.
What's it going to be like being in the majority?
It's going to be unbelievable. We've spent that's the last 6 or 8 months meeting on a pretty regular basis, the policy committee, to make sure we're prepared once we get the majority, because we've all read, the writing has been on the wall that this was going to happen. And it's important for me, it's important for us as Democrats, that we produce some real results, but that we don't overreach. That we in this first session, we produce some results and in a pretty dramatic fashion, and I think we can do that.
Are there any specific bills that you have in mind that you're going to drop before the General Assembly?
Nothing different than what I've done before. You know, my focus will remain exactly where it's been in the past, on fixing problems that need to be fixed that affect the people I represent, and on addressing mental health on a statewide basis. I want to make sure that people that need services can get them no matter what their zip code.
I just finished talking to Delegate-elect Sally Hudson, and she says that one of her priorities is election reform.
And what we need to do is remove barriers so we can have more people participate in elections. And I'm excited about Sally's election. I'm excited about our service to come and the partnership that I hope that we can form to better serve our constituents.
You have a few weeks before the General Assembly takes its seat. Do you have any plans for taking a mini vacation?
I'm a lawyer. I got to work for a living. You know, I've got a tree that fell on my property several months ago that has to be chopped up, and my chicken house needs to be cleaned. I plan on taking care of those chores, and I plan on doing that in pretty short order, probably tomorrow.
Well, Senator Credeeds, it's been a long day. Thank you for your time. Thank you for joining us again on the Score from Bearing Drift. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Did you miss a previous episode of The Score? Look for our podcast at bearingdrift.com.
Delegate-elect Sally Hudson ran unopposed for the 57th House seat vacated by retiring Delegate David Toscano. When she was previously a guest on The Score, we talked about her ideas for election reform, including ranked choice voting. That topic came up again on election night.
Sally Hudson, you were just elected almost unanimously to the House of Delegates. 96% is what I heard. What's the first bill you're going to drop as a member of the General Assembly?
The work that I'm most excited to do is on election reform. I think that we need an overhaul of Virginia election law to ensure that our elections are responsive to the voters for the long haul.
And specifically, what are you going to be working on?
I think that there's a range of ballots. Some of them are basic ballot access issues where Virginia is really behind the times in other states, whether that's no excuse early voting or extended polling hours. But there are also deeper structural reforms like independent redistricting. I've also been a really active advocate for ranked choice voting, which is something that I'd like to continue to champion.
Nick Freitas was reelected today with a write-in campaign. Are you going to be working with him on RCV?
He's been a strong supporter of ranked choice voting in the past, and I look forward to partnering with him on that.
It's one thing that can be a bipartisan issue.
Absolutely. It's not something that should be partisan at all. It's all about making sure that the genuine will of the majority is heard, even in fields with diverse candidates, which is what we want.
And ranked choice voting has been used in Maine for a few elections now. What results have you seen there in the way voters respond to it?
Well, I think what we've seen most importantly is that the voters really like it. The exit polls show that voters understand how it works, that they really enjoy having the opportunity to vote their conscience. They get to vote their hopes, not their fears. That's what we like about ranked choice voting. In fact, Maine voters like it so much that they went from using it to elect the mayor of Portland, Maine, to their congressional and their governor's elections in 2018, and now in 2020 they're going to use it in the presidential election.
That'll be something interesting to watch. This was your first time running as a candidate for public office. What reactions do you have to that? What did you learn from being a candidate that you didn't know before you ran?
That there's really no substitute for meeting voters where they're at. All of those conversations you have on doorsteps mean the world.
And what did you learn from the voters?
I think I learned I learned what I knew, which is that this is an incredibly diverse community with diverse needs. You've got some voters for whom the top priority are those deeper structural issues like election reform. They have the luxury of looking at the long haul. And we've got lots of families here in Charlottesville that are trying to figure out how to put food on the table tomorrow. And so how do we handle both our short-term acute needs and those longer-term priorities that give us a healthier democracy for the long haul? That's the challenge of governing here in Charlottesville.
Now, the city of Charlottesville, Albemarle County, the 57th District, had huge voter turnout, much more than expected, and apparently this has been across the state. What do you think explains the high voter turnout this year as compared to previous similar elections, like 2015?
I think that voters have come to embrace the tremendous power they have in state and local elections. I think that there's a temptation for us to be transfixed by national politics, but I think that the total dysfunction in D.C. has caused people to kind of pull into their local communities and say, how can I have an impact here at home? And that's really exciting to see people take a really strong stake in their state and local elections.
The General Assembly has a session starting in January. What will you be doing between now and then to prepare for taking your seat?
Well, I think everything hinges on whether or not Democrats find ourselves in the majority. You know, it's early here tonight, but some signs point toward a change in power. That means that Democrats are going to have to assemble our own leadership and sign our own committees. You know, it's been a long time since we've been the party in power, and so we've got a lot of work to do on that front.
There are a lot of voters who voted today who were not yet born the last time the Democrats had full control of the Virginia government.
I might have been one of them. When was the last?
1997.
Okay.
Well, 1997 was the last time the Democrats had control of the General Assembly, and before that, when Democrats had, you know, the governor's mansion plus the General Assembly, it was probably back in the 80s.
Yeah, so I'm an 88 baby, yeah. So it's entirely possible I'm one of them.
Yeah, it's a big change in Virginia. Delegate-elect Hudson, thank you for joining us on the Score from Bering Drift. I'm sure we'll be talking again once the General Assembly starts in earnest in January.
Looking forward to it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Do you have an idea for future episodes of The Score? Write to host Rick Sincere at ricksincere@gmail.com.
Charlottesville Democrats once again swept the election for city council. Three candidates were on their ticket: Lloyd Snook, Sina McGill, and Michael Payne. I spoke to Payne, a self-described progressive, on election night about his ideas about housing and other topics.
Michael Payne, just elected to the Charlottesville City Council. My first question is, you're a first-time candidate. What did you learn as a candidate that you didn't know before as a political activist?
A lot of, you know, I've been involved in campaigns a lot of the nuts and bolts of it. I mean, part of it was just how difficult it is to run for office as a working person. I'm not independently wealthy. I'm not retired. I had to keep working while running for office. And it's really hard to try and balance both of those roles while keeping the rent paid. I mean, that was just something that being in the campaign, experiencing directly. Other than that, you know, I think generally going canvassing, you just learn a lot about each neighborhood. You learn a lot about the issues affecting people, and that people are really focused on bread and butter issues of, you know, how am I going to pay my rent? What are my bills like? And that's really what a lot of people, you know, are concerned with. And connecting to those issues is a way to bring more people into the political process and increase turnout.
What are some things that you learned from voters as you were going door to door that you hadn't really considered before?
Every neighborhood has, you know, its own thing that might not necessarily make citywide news, but is something going on within their neighborhood. You know, I'm thinking of just a random example, you know, like in the Rose Hill neighborhood, they had a whole recent issue of the city changing in an intersection from stop signs to stoplights, and there was a whole, you know, discussion around that for everything in the neighborhood. You know, a specific example of something, you know, I learned canvassing is learning from folks how big of an impact there is on homes. Energy bills going up in the winter on older homes, which tend to be more affordable homes that either aren't well insulated or don't have any insulation, and it drives up the energy prices. And that's tied to work that LEAP and other organizations are doing to connect the issue of green retrofitting and reducing emissions to economic justice. And that's just one random example, but it's that kind of thing that happens throughout the city that you just, you know, you really learn going door to door talking to people.
Years ago, a friend of mine who served on the Arlington County Board told me that if you're not interested in gutters and leaf collection, you don't belong on a county board of supervisors or a city council. It's not a place for great structural changes. But you have some ambitious ideas that you'd like to advance. How do you expect to do that?
Listen, you know, a lot of the work of city council is nuts and bolts work when it comes to, say, updating the zoning, getting, you know, streets to work, things like that. But I think there's a lot of progressive policy change that happens within those policies. I mean, you look at zoning. zoning impacts housing affordability. It intersects with the legacy of redlining and racial covenants. You look at creating a regional transit authority, which can improve public transportation, which positively impacts working families and is connected to climate. You have issues like divesting from fossil fuels, setting emissions reduction target goals locally. And especially now, as seems very possible, the General Assembly may flip this evening to control of Democrats, and that's going to open up huge opportunities that didn't exist before for City Council to work with the General Assembly to see if we can get the General Assembly to allow us to implement policies like a citywide living wage. And I think we're seeing, you know, at least for the moment, action on climate change, racial justice, economic justice. It's not going to come from Republicans at the federal level, and that means that it's up to us at a local and state level to really take action. And are there limits to what we can do? Absolutely. Is a lot of what we do non-ideological, nuts and bolts stuff? Absolutely. But even in that work, I think there's a lot of things we can do that can have a positive impact on working families.
Voter turnout today in Charlottesville was far higher than expected. Not anything like previous similar elections. They were printing ballots all afternoon to fit the needs. What do you think explains that high voter turnout in Charlottesville and to another extent across the state today?
Yeah, I mean, I think within Charlottesville specifically, I think there's a lot of people who got engaged in local politics for the first time after the summer of 2017 who are still engaged and still paying attention, and a lot of people who've been brought into the political process, and again, not just voting, but also canvassing, telling their friends and neighbors about local politics in a way they haven't before, and that's part of the turnout. As well as, I think there was definitely a blue wave across Virginia this evening, across the state, where people were enthusiastic about recognizing that action isn't coming from the federal government right now. So for us to resist the not just Trump, but the root causes of Trumpism, that means taking action at a local and state level, and that means flipping the General Assembly and unlocking opportunities to take action on all these issues. And I think that motivated a lot of people to vote.
There are a few weeks before you take office. What are you going to be doing between now and then to spend your time?
Well, I'm still working, so I'll be working with Pacham, doing that work as well. But when it comes to council work, I'm going to continue to reach out to existing councilors and city staff to just as much as possible get more and more up to speed on issues facing the city and more up to speed on the specific work that council has been engaged in and how we can continue that work, particularly when it comes to redevelopment of public housing and local climate issues. I have existing relationships with Wes, Nakaya, and Heather Hill, and want to continue to meet with them. Likewise, throughout the campaign, Sina McGill, Lloyd Snook, and myself are regularly meeting and figuring out what are the issues that we can get to work on day one. And our priority is going to be continue to build that relationship and really, again, be able to come in and take action on actual policies so people can see and believe that City Council is capable of working together on real policy solutions and make a positive impact.
Well, Michael Payne, thank you for your time today, and thank you for running for office. And I appreciate you joining us on the Score from Bering. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The Score is produced by Bering Drift, Virginia's top site for news and politics. To learn more, visit beringdrift.com.
On the day after the election in Virginia, I spoke by telephone with Dr. Stephen Farnsworth, a political scientist at the University of Mary Washington in Fredericksburg. He's a longtime observer of politics in the Old Dominion. I started off by asking if he was surprised by any of the election results.
Consistent pattern over the last several election cycles in Virginia. The results in 2019 mirrored pretty closely the results in 2018 and then in 2017 before that, where the Democratic Party and their candidates did much better in the suburbs than they normally did, and the Republicans didn't do nearly as well in territory that used to be comfortably theirs.
So you were expecting this result. I think almost any observer who is looking at what might happen predicted that the Democrats were going to take control of the two chambers of the General Assembly. The only question was by how much of a margin. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that this was a largely expected outcome. Poll numbers showed a consistent advantage for the Democrats in terms of enthusiasm. When you look at the amount of money as well that was raised, the Democrats were able to outspend Republicans. And that doesn't happen all that often in Virginia, but it did happen this year. And so the Democrats might have had a little bit better night in Virginia Beach than a lot of people might have thought, but ultimately the overall pattern of the Republican majority control in both chambers coming to an end was something that a lot of people did expect.
What do you think explains the unusually high turnout? I don't know whether it was even across the state, but certainly in Charlottesville and Albemarle County, where I'm based, they were talking about 20% more than 4 years ago in some cases. Charlottesville printed 10,000 ballots in advance. They needed to print another 5,000 during Election Day to keep up with the number of people who came to vote. Did you expect that kind of turnout?
Well, we certainly expected the turnout in this Virginia midterm to be considerably higher than the Virginia midterm 4 years ago. There were more candidates running. There were higher quality candidates running. The candidates who were running had a lot more money to spend to build up interest. First President Trump has an impact, too. Both supporters and opponents of the president have gotten more engaged in politics these last several years, and that creates an environment where turnout is going to be high. But this was really pretty consistently high across the state, much more than you usually see in this particular Virginia midterm, which is famous for having the lowest turnout of each four-year election cycle in Virginia.
In terms of the Trump effect, I think a lot of Republicans were thinking that the opposition to the impeachment process was going to motivate Republican voters, but that didn't seem to happen. Do you think that points to what the rest of the country might react to the impeachment process if Virginia was like that?
Yeah, I think that it's important to recognize that the people who are paying that much attention to the impeachment process are going to be pretty much committed either to really liking the president or really disliking the president. For most people, it's not going to really register at this point. These hearings are not in public. It's not the high visibility moment that the impeachment hearing itself would be once that process is taking place out in open hearing. The reality for impeachment, I think, is that it really is going to build up support for the president among people who already support him, and it's going to build up opposition even more intensely from the people who already oppose him. There are not a lot of people in this country who are undecided about President Trump. He's very visible and has made very aggressive statements, very, very clear where he stands on a wide variety of issues. And it seems to me that the polls show that there's only a few single-digit percentage points of voters who are willing to describe themselves as undecided on Trump.
Aside from the great deal of enthusiasm shown by Democrats coming into this election, explaining their turnout and their victories, do you think that there is a dissipation of effort by the Republican Party of Virginia? It seems to be running something of a clown show for the past few years.
Well, I think the Republican Party has to retool. I think you learn a lot more from defeats than victories, and the lesson, I think, for Republicans in 2020 is that the party needs to be much more competitive in the suburbs. The reality is that Virginia is getting more diverse, and suburbs in Virginia particularly so, and the messaging, particularly in the age of President Trump, is not well-suited to winning votes with the electorate in the suburban areas where it's much more diverse. It's diverse in terms of race and ethnicity, but it's also more diverse than it used to be in terms of age. And younger voters, if they get interested in politics, that's not generally a good sign for Republicans because younger voters, people under 30, tend to vote Republican about 2-1. I mean, Democratic about 2-1.
Do you think that Republicans can reach out to these new voters, especially recent immigrants or recent migrants from other states into Virginia, but stay to their traditional program of smaller government, lower taxes, but they just have to frame those issues in a different way?
Well, I think there is an opportunity for that. If you think about your suburban voter, they're really kind of cross-threshold. Oftentimes you're talking about people who are buying homes and maybe they've invested a lot of their savings into those properties, and so they're very concerned about the economy and how much they're paying in taxes. They may not be very interested in the Republican message if it focuses on abortion or anti-immigration, but they might be very interested in a message that's more oriented towards careful use of government resources, lower taxes, and so on. So I think that there's an opportunity for the Republicans. And this, of course, is something that the Republicans themselves recognize if you look at the party after the 2012 presidential election, the Republican Party leadership put together a report that specifically said that the future of the Republican Party is not doubling down on white voters, but rather figuring out ways, particularly connecting with Latino Americans. And the Trump presidency, of course, is the exact opposite of that sort of welcome wagon vision that the Republican leadership envisioned in 2012.
What do you foresee in terms of the way the Democrats run the General Assembly? I read today that there are already two people saying they're challenging Eileen Filler Corn for the speakership. I didn't expect that. I figured that as the minority leader, she was primed to be the first female speaker of the House in Virginia history, but people want to stand in her way. What do you think is going to happen with the Democrats once they're in control in Richmond?
The big question for Democrats is that a sort of unmet need. I mean, there's so many issues that the Democrats have wanted to have on the agenda that they haven't been able to put them on the agenda because of the challenges that they face when they're in the minority. And of course, we're talking about 25 years in which the either the House or the Senate or the governor's office has been under the control of Republicans. I mean, unified Democratic control is something that most of these Democrats had only dreamed of until today. The reality then is that they'll control the agenda, expect an increase in the minimum wage, expect a much greater environmental regulation. I envision a lot of the money that is being allocated will be allocated more towards schools and transit, and it'll be moving in a direction towards more suburban voters and less in the way of moving towards rural voters. I think that there aren't too many Democrats to get elected in rural parts of Virginia, and so those rural areas might not get the very kind treatment that the Republicans have offered rural voters because that's where their constituents were from.
One other issue I want to ask you about, because the Democrats are, as you say, taking control of the agenda. For years, Democrats have argued in favor of redistricting reform of some form or another. Now that they're in charge, will they actually carry that out, or will they want to control the redistricting process?
Yeah, that's a good question, and we'll see what they say now that they have the levers of control. There might be a great temptation, at least among some Democrats, to do to the Republicans what the Republicans did to them, specifically drawing lines in ways that are very unappealing to the party and the minority. The Democrats have talked about redistricting reform. They've supported it, but it doesn't go to the voters as a constitutional amendment unless the exact same piece of legislation that was passed last year is passed again, or last winter, is passed again during the 2020 session. And so one way that the Democrats would say that they favor redistricting reform, but nevertheless get to draw lines one more time before it takes effect, is to put forward a new redistricting constitutional amendment, which would then have to go through this session in 2020, and then again in 2022. And it won't go to the voters until then. And what that'll mean is an opportunity for the Democrats to draw the lines one last time before that redistricting amendment takes effect. So there's a way that you can say you're pro-constitutional reform on redistricting, but not actually have to live under it. And that may be one of the scenarios the Democrats are going to be contemplating in the weeks ahead.
Well, Dr. Stephen Farnsworth of the University of Mary Washington, thank you for your comments today. I appreciate you joining us again on The Score from Bering Drift, and I expect that the next few months of Virginia politics is going to be exciting to watch. Do you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. There'll be lots to pay attention to in the weeks and months ahead.
Well, thank you again.
Last week on The Score, we had a chance to talk with several filmmakers at the 32nd Annual Virginia Film Festival, including actor Dennis Christopher, who was celebrating the 40th anniversary of the Oscar-winning movie Breaking Away. This week, we have another Oscar winner, documentary filmmaker Paul Wagner, who is based in Charlottesville. His newest film is called Fishing with Dynamite, and it focuses in on the moral and economic crisis facing American businesses. We talked just before the film screened at the Virginia Film Festival.
Let me just start with some background questions.
Sure.
Paul Wagner, you're a documentary filmmaker.
Mm-hmm.
Did you wake up one morning and when you were 7 years old and said, I want to make movies about stonecutters and corporate raiders?
No, absolutely. In fact, I was always jealous of people like Steven Spielberg, who, you know, described their sort of origin story as, you know, seeing a movie when they were 8 years old and being transfixed and transformed and wanting to be a filmmaker. I came to it very late. I came from a family in the Midwest, wonderful people, God-fearing people, but not rooted in the arts and or in media. And so I was out of graduate school before I actually even occurred to me to become a filmmaker. I took another year of schooling, studied documentary film, and then just sort of declared myself a filmmaker.
What career were you preparing for before you decided to become a filmmaker?
No career. That was the problem. I was kind of an eternal student. I had been an English major undergraduate. I had studied communications in graduate school, but not... We never picked up a camera. It was communications as sociology and communications research analysis. So I was headed for a PhD, basically, and was enrolled in the PhD program at the Annenberg School at the University of Pennsylvania. But that's where I took a documentary film course and thought, wow, this is a lot more fun than becoming a PhD and teaching, you know, being on teaching theoretical communications for the rest of my life. So I sort of jumped out of the theoretical track and declared myself a filmmaker after really just one film course. But I fell in with some friends in Philadelphia who were folklorists. They were finishing their PhDs in folklore, and we started making films mostly about their PhD, you know, dissertation topics. And that's where the Stonecarvers came from, for example.
Well, that's interesting, but let's jump forward a couple
decades. About 40 years.
Yeah. And your new film, Fishing with Dynamite.
Right.
What's it about?
Yeah, it's funny. That title, Fishing with Dynamite, I love that title because I think it catches people's attention. The downside is it tells them nothing about what the film is about.
Yeah, you think you're going off onto a trout stream in Montana. Or
exactly, and it definitely is not a trout stream in Montana. So Fishing with Dynamite is a documentary about corporations and greed, and that's where the title comes from. Fishing with Dynamite basically is what corporations, many corporations, are doing today, which is they're focused totally on short-term profits. So they throw the dynamite in the lake, they catch a lot of fish in the short term, and in the process destroy the lake in the long term. And so that's the problem we're facing with many, many corporations and the way corporations think about themselves and about society. And what we suggest is, we point out the problems that this is creating, not just with our economy, but with our democracy, around issues like income inequality, for example. One of the root causes is this theory called maximizing shareholder value, the idea that you can do anything. All you have to do is maximize your quarterly return of your corporation, and you're a success. And we juxtapose that against a much more positive and forward-thinking idea, which is the stakeholder approach, that a corporation should be responsible to their employees, to their customers, to their suppliers, to the environment and the community in which they live, and their shareholders. So it's not that, you know, this, we're opposed to the importance of shareholders. We're just saying they are one of many stakeholders that corporations should pay attention to.
How long did it take for you to get from the spark of an idea to getting the film into its current form?
Well, it took us several years to do it. People who know my films know that's sort of how I work. I love documentary filmmaking mainly because I love learning. For me, it's like I never left college. And so with this film, I really knew very little about corporations and business, the history of Adam Smith and his sense of what a corporation is and how capitalism is supposed to work. And so I spent several years, really a couple of years before I even picked up the camera, trying to learn. And I was learning from the ethics department at the Darden School of Business, and specifically a professor, Bidden Parmer, who is a brilliant young ethics teacher at Darden, and Jenny Mead, who also co-produced the film with us, who's a senior researcher at Darden. So I learned from them and from Ed Freeman, who is a professor at Darden, who actually sort of, you know, imagined and created the stakeholder approach to corporations. So we had kind of the guru of that philosophy available to us that I learned from. And then we filmed it. We interviewed many people, Robert Reich, that a lot of people are familiar with, but also a guy named Arthur Brooks, who's the head of the American Enterprise Institute. I specifically wanted to interview people on the left and the right. And we actually have a segment in the film where, as you would expect, they disagree about everything except they both agree in the stakeholder approach to corporations, which is pretty interesting and really thrilling for me. Just around the politics of the day, it's really important that we find, you know, directions in our politics and in our ideology that transcend this tiresome, you know, unproductive left-right dichotomy.
Were you also able to interview corporate executives, and did you get any pushback from them when they knew what the topic of your film was?
Yeah. Well, the ones we talked to are fabulous CEOs. We talked to the CEO and the founder, actually, of Costco, which I personally think is a great company, and I know a lot of people consider to be a great company, a guy named Jim Sinegal, who's very articulate about, of course, the corporation has to be productive and profitable, but you have a greater responsibility to all the people who are, you know, depend on you as a company. We also talked to the founders of Whole Foods Markets, who, and that Whole Foods is very much a stakeholder company. Now, of course, they've been bought by Amazon. A lot of people are kind of watching how that's going to affect their corporate culture. In my mind, that's still a little bit up in the air. It's not clear which way they'll go. But they certainly were founded and operated for several decades as a stakeholder company. So we do interview CEOs. It's not that easy to get a CEO or even someone from Wall Street to say, oh, I'm all for greed.
But, unless it's Gordon Gekko.
Yeah, right. And actually, we have Gordon Gekko in the film. Michael Douglas, playing Gordon Gekko in the film, is one of the characters in the film. We use clips from that film and a lot of other Hollywood films. It's not that hard to find Hollywood films acknowledging that corporations are greedy. It's just tough to get a CEO of a corporation to admit it.
Well, and in fact, looking back at Hollywood films, it's very hard to find any narrative feature that treats business people as good.
Exactly. I mean, this idea of corporate greed is just built into our assumptions about capitalism. And, you know, it's unfortunate, but it's certainly a reality. And, you know, we try to point out in the film, you know, there is a way to think about, you know, I don't want to get too Ayn Randish on you, but there is a way to think about corporations as doing good in the world. And actually, it's not that far-fetched. You know, we're bringing this film out at a time when I have the feeling there's a very receptive audience out there, millennials especially, which I am decidedly not. I'm getting up there, but millennials, you know, they don't accept the fact that capitalism has to be the only way this society operates. I'm concerned about that. I'm not a huge fan of socialism. On the other hand, clearly capitalism has gone off the rails. And so it seems to me the best solution is to go back and determine what does it mean when we say an authentic capitalism, a true capitalism that serves the interests of society broadly and these particular stakeholders that we're talking about in the film. And can't we get back on track and actually go back to what Adam Smith talked about? You know, they talk about Adam Smith and self-interest. Yes, he did talk about that. He also wrote a book about the moral imperative in our society and how individuals inherently care about other individuals, and that was part of his philosophy about what capitalism should be.
Yeah, well, the Wealth of Nations came after the theory of moral sentiment.
Exactly.
And it was part of his whole philosophy. And do you think that there's a difference in how we think about these issues if we refer not to capitalism, but to the free enterprise system?
Well, I think that's probably a good point. You know, we are stuck with these terms to some extent, but I think your point's well taken. And, you know, issues around crony capitalism, for example, which I find really troubling. Look, the more responsible the corporations act, the less the government is going to have to interfere with them, you know. So this idea that, we don't want governments interfering with corporations, that's nice to say if you're on the left or right. But the fact is, when corporations misbehave, what do they expect to happen? Of course the political currents are going to move towards demanding that the government, put their hand on the scales of the market economy. And better if we could get corporations to do the right thing, then government doesn't have to be as involved. Obviously, we want government to be involved at certain, you know, macro levels. But we don't want government, I don't at least, want government going in and determining, you know, too rigidly the behavior of corporations and stifling a free enterprise system and an open market system that has generated unbelievable wealth and prosperity and lifted billions of people out of poverty over the last several years. So even as you look across the world and you see this rise in economic well-being for, you know, countries across the world, when you look more specifically, as we do in the film, in American capitalism, it's too much of a negative story over the last 40 years. And it dates, there are many reasons why, but it dates largely to the shift to maximizing shareholder value that happened in the 1970s.
We're talking to documentary filmmaker Paul Wagner. We're at the Virginia Film Festival. We're screening your film, Fishing with Dynamite, today. What are the plans for further distribution? Where might people see it if they're not in Charlottesville today?
Right. Well, eventually I think it'll be a public television broadcast, but all those plans are just now being put together. I'm excited because there's a plan now to premiere the film in Washington, D.C., for the kind of political and lobbying world, and in New York City for the Wall Street, business world. And I think those will be really impactful because, you know, I produced a lot of documentary films. Some of them really click when they come out, others not so much. And it doesn't matter how good the film is. It matters if the society and the culture at that moment is ready for that film and the message of that film. And I feel pretty strongly that this film is going to find a passionate audience because people really are hungry for this information.
Well, Paul, thank you for joining us on The Score from Bering Drift. This is the second year in a row I've spoken to you at the Virginia Film Festival. So good luck with this film, and I look forward to seeing it.
Great. Thanks, Rick.
Thank you.
One of the founders of the Virginia Film Festival was former Governor Gerald Baliles, who passed away earlier this month. I was able to ask him about the beginnings of the film festival in November 2013. From the archives, here is the late Gerald Baliles.
Governor Baliles, more than 25 years ago, you've co-founded the Virginia Film Festival. Did you ever have this kind of expectation for where it would be today?
When one launches a new venture, one has a vision. One has hopes, expectations. I thought it was entirely conceivable that the first couple of years, if they went well, would provide the setting for a much larger public acceptance and interest and support of what has come to be known as the Virginia Film Festival. It is impossible to predict the details, but it is also possible to envision the possibilities, and that's what we had 26 years ago.
One of your goals was to expand the Virginia film industry, too. Do you think those goals have been met?
Well, every state in this country is, and including foreign countries, are competing for production of films in their own localities. But when I was a young legislator, I was struck by a film that was made in Hampton Roads. And I read that the producers had left 40% of their budget in Hampton Roads. And I thought, why don't we do this sort of thing? Other states had film offices. So I put a bill in to create a Virginia Film Office as a way of enticing producers to come to the state. We would provide advice and counsel and scouting locations and that sort of thing. The bill was killed. I happen to serve on the Appropriations Committee, and the budget always contains a lot of fine print in the back. So when my bill was killed, I just inserted the same language in the back of the budget. The budget was approved, of course, and so was the film office. And the film office then started, to create the possibilities of attracting film producers to the state. The Virginia Film Festival was created some 10 or 15 years later when I was in office as governor. So my interest in film has been one of long standing. I read a lot. I am a voracious reader. But I also recognize we are a visual society, and pictures speak louder than words.
Just shifting gears for a moment, as a former governor, do you have any advice for the incoming governor who was elected last Tuesday?
I think it's always the province of the new governor to bring his own vision, and ideas and framework for governing the state. I only give advice when asked, and I never talk about the advice I've given.
I understand that very much. But thank you for your remarks. I appreciate it. I appreciate the film festival, too.
Thanks.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have this week on The Score. For all the editors and writers at Bering Drift, I'm Rick Sincere. We'll be back next week with more news, reviews, and interviews. Be sure to tell your friends where to find us, and feel free to join the conversation on our website at beringdrift.com. We'll be looking for you.
Do you have an idea for future episodes of The Score? Write to host Rick Sincere at ricksincere@gmail.com. The Score is produced by Bering Drift, Virginia's top site for news and politics. To learn more, visit beringdrift.com.